IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm Netansha Bansal. Today we'll talk about the digital world, internet, social media and politics. Before I introduce my guest for the day, I would like to inform you that Takshashila's 12-week graduate certificate programs in policy are now open for admission. The last date to apply is 28th of August 2021. For more details, please visit takshashila.org.in/courses. In the early years of internet and social media, they made optimistic promises in the form of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, universal accessibility of information. And with its promise of bringing the world closer, the internet became everyone's favorite tool. Cut to the present times, we see these social media platforms being blamed for exacerbating polarization and xenophobia, facilitating violent protests, and for spreading false information. What we also have today is a tussle for power between the government and social media platforms. To help us make sense of this digital world we find ourselves in and to decode the phenomena of social media platforms, I have Prateek Waghre with me today. Prateek is a research analyst with the Technology and Policy Program at the Takshashila Institution. He's the curator of Ms. Tismal Information Newsletter and also writes for the Technopolitic Newsletter. You can find the link to both the newsletters in the description. Hello, Prateek.
Hey, Tancha, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
Doing good.
Right. So let's start with explaining to our listeners what is social media and what attributes of social media make it different from the traditional sources of information.
Yeah, so that's a great question, right? And you would think we have a clear answer to that, but it's actually incredible that different people still tend to think of the term social media in different ways, right? Most often, you know, what comes to mind when you think of social media, you think Facebook, you think Twitter, right? To some extent, now we think of TikTok, right? Do we consider Clubhouse pure social media? Right? Again, there is I've seen different opinions on that, but I think, you know, largely we tend to sort of bucket these as social media applications that we use, right? From the perspective of, you know, characteristics, right? What differentiates them from traditional media, right? And let's just make a distinction, right? In the sense that these are all platforms where we go and consume information. There is a question of, hey, are they publishers? Are they just intermediaries? These are all questions that we're still struggling to answer, right? They fall in between the established mechanism that we have to look at these things of whether, hey, a newspaper is a publisher versus, you know, me saying something on the street, I'm of course not a publisher, right? So social media platforms sort of come in between that, and that's why it's gotten a little fuzzy, and which is why we're still struggling to deal with a lot of the problems, a lot of the issues that have arisen as a result of them, right? But to go back specifically to characteristics, right? And this is what I think researchers have tended to define it as one, that they have very low entry cost or low transaction costs, right? In the sense that anyone can post, right? It's easy for you to communicate with someone sitting at the other side of the world, things like that. And there is a heavy reliance on user-generated content, right? Which is, so you're no longer restricted to a certain set of individuals or certain organizations or groups creating content. Anyone can go and create content there, right? So you have, so they've enabled, you know, one-to-one communication, one-to-many, and many-to-many communication, and you can do all this pretty much instantaneously, right? And there's also an aspect of, look, there is a reliance on algorithmic feeds, right, which curate content for a user based on their interest or based on what they've done. And there's typically a combination of public and private communication. This is what most people think of, this is what you can attribute as the main characteristics of social media.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And I also think that, you know, everybody is a publisher now, as you mentioned, that anybody could publish, but as an individual, we never thought of ourselves to be a publisher of an information or something. But now that look at Twitter or Facebook and maybe LinkedIn for that matter, everybody has become a publisher. But I also do feel at times that maybe my world of news is different from somebody else's world of news, precisely because it's so tailor-made. The algorithms make my feed so different from somebody else that at times I just wonder if my news is the same as somebody else's, and the importance, what is the importance that I'm giving to particular news is not exactly same as what somebody else is giving importance to that piece of information. So, of course, that's also something that even though the world's been brought closer, but in a way, it's also been differentiated in many ways because of social media.
Yeah, I think I've heard the term being used for that, one world, many realities.
Yeah, that's great, I think, yeah. And I also wonder at times that, you know, we see this the problem of not having a concrete definition for social media, especially in India right now. I think that it's definitely an ongoing debate. But what is your opinion about WhatsApp? Do we call it a social media platform? Same for like an iMessage. Is that something that we consider as social media?
No, that's a good question, right? And I think specifically pertinent for India, because if you look at user base, right, WhatsApp is by far the largest. And it doesn't fall under the traditional definition of social media, though it tends to be clubbed, right? People tend to say social media applications and messaging services, right? It tends to get clubbed under that bucket. But you know, if you look at certain characteristics, if you look at specifically the aspect of algorithmic feed, then yes, WhatsApp doesn't have that, right? So whenever we're considering issues that arise out of algorithmic feed, right, and out of that tailoring of content, those do not specifically apply to WhatsApp from the perspective of an organization or a corporation controlling that content. Of course, you have to account for people inorganically pushing content to certain WhatsApp groups and communities that we may be on. But you know, this is an issue, right? In terms of how we look at these things. And so, in a forthcoming paper, what we've tried to do is we've proposed the term digital communication networks, right? Which has three components. There's the capability aspect, which is similar to what I described earlier, right? Where you have essentially you're talking about internet-based products and services that help you, that enable you to communicate instantaneously and in the ways that I described, right? You have one to one, you have one to many, you have many to many, right? You can broadcast. Then the second component is what we're calling operators, which is essentially you can think of them as either firms, right, companies, or even groups that operate these products and services. And finally, you have networks, which is, you know, again, they could be entities, they could be groups, they could be individuals that adopt and use these products, right? And I think our thinking for framing this definition was to enable us to look at it from the perspective of not just, hey, Facebook is doing this or Twitter is doing this, right? It's about trying to understand the combined effects on society, right? And it's, you know, and when you say Facebook, right, are you talking about Facebook the company? Are you talking about Facebook and its users? And then we often find there's this finger pointing between, hey, the company does this, but the user, you know, but it's also because users are clicking on that or users tend to engage with that kind of content. And, you know, in that back and forth, right, like exactly what's happening right now in the US, right, with Biden saying that because of anti-vax information, Facebook is potentially killing people. And then Facebook responds to saying that, hey, no, we're not doing that. X million people saw vaccine information on Facebook, et cetera, right? So you get lost in this back and forth. And what we're trying to say is that, look, we need to understand this from, you know, from the composite effects that it has on societies and how these networks exist across different platforms, right? It's not just on Facebook. There is a combination of how these networks play across different social media platforms or different digital communication operators, right? And those networks and traditional media has an interplay as well, right? So that's what we're trying to do with that definition.
Right. And I think this makes so much more sense than any definition which has come up as of now with respect to social media, because I think we need to dehyphenate the companies and these private corporations from the phenomena of social media. I think there's a full-fledged world of social media that we neglect because we try to focus on one type of a platform which has been provided, which really takes away or takes the scholars away from the main crux of the argument or the debate, or to understand what actually is it about social media which is leading to, you know, some changes if we see them at all.
Yeah. I do want to point out, right? The idea of doing this is not necessarily to try and take responsibility away from these companies. I think that's not the intent, right? It's not that we're trying to shield anything. Like you said, right? The idea is to try and look at how these interplay, right, between what the actions that these companies or corporations take and how networks then go and use that, right? And again, I'm using networks as a single term, but there are, again, multiple components within them as well, right? And essentially, the goal is to try and understand those and focus on those effects.
Right, that makes so much sense. All right, so before we dive deeper into this topic, let's take a brief break, and I request our listeners to stay tuned. Hello everyone, welcome back to All Things Policy. Before we took a break, we tried to understand why social media is such a relevant topic of discussion in policy these days. We'll now talk about how it affects different political regimes, if it does at all. So Prateek, before we went out on a break, I think you had set the perfect backdrop for my next question. And so this is actually a question which has boggled my mind during every election phase. Every time there's an election, this is something that I think about a lot. And after the first phase of the conversation, I think you're the best person to answer this. So do you think that social media or social media platforms, they affect different political regimes differently? Say, you know, a democratic regime versus an authoritarian regime, if they affect them at all?
So, yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know if I'm necessarily the best person to answer this. But yes, I do spend an inordinate amount of time thinking about things like this, right? And before I specifically answer your question, I do want to address one other quick point, in the sense that a couple of weeks ago, there was a joint paper that was put out, and it spoke about stewardship of global collective behavior, right? And this sort of continues from our earlier point about the effects of social media, right? And I do want to point out some of the things that they said, because I think it's important for our listeners to put that in context as well, right? And what they said about, you know, the scale of the changes that social media has, or this, you know, our new sort of communication paradigm that's shifted in the last 10 years, right? It happened at a speed that we haven't seen before. And as a result of that, it resulted in an increased scale of human networks, right? That we've just not had. We were talking about, right, how you can communicate with someone at the other end of the world pretty much instantly. They also spoke about changes in network structure, right? In the sense that your networks are no longer local and limited by geography, right? It's completely spread across the world, and there's an impact on information fidelity, right? And if we can think of this as, you know, the amount of information we have, right? There is, you know, what we typically call information overload, and then you don't necessarily know what is accurate information, what is false information, who's doing what deliberately, right? So it creates this problem of information fidelity, where you don't know how to, you know, what to make of a certain message or a certain piece of information, and even, you know, collectively in terms of what to make of all the information that's flowing. And the last component, which is algorithmic feedback, right? And this goes back to the first part where we're talking about a subset of digital communication networks which rely on algorithms. And the reason I'm saying this is because I think, you know, the point that they mentioned about the increased scale and the change in network structure and information fidelity, right, that ties very closely into the political effects and, you know, that they have on regime tech, right, which is what you asked me. So, you know, I apologize for that slight digression, but I just wanted to set that context. To your specific question, there was recently a very interesting paper, and we linked to that in the Texas National Review, which looked at this concept of, or this idea of how social media, how communication of this sort is going to affect different regime types. And they looked at it from the perspective of three political actors, which is your domestic opposition. That's pretty self-explanatory. External forces. Now, this can contain, you know, various multinational corporations as well as international adversaries, right, or political regimes that share an adversarial relationship with that particular regime and the governing regime itself. And what they did is they then defined this, classified them on the basis of strength, whether it's a weak regime or a strong regime, and the type, right? Whether it's authoritarian or democratic or liberal democratic, as they say, right? And what they did this on the basis of case studies, and I'll just quickly cover that. So what they said was, if it's a weak authoritarian regime, and they took the example of Egypt, they said this, you know, digital communication networks, although they use the term social media, I'm going to use digital communication networks, had a destabilizing political effect. Right? And it is an interesting choice of word. Note that they didn't say liberalizing, they said destabilizing, because, and I think that's an apt choice in the sense that we have seen how things played out in Egypt after the initial, you know, wave of protest and the Mubarak regime fell, right? But they also caution, right, that while they've been able to enable protests, etc., they're also cautioning that in the last few years, even these regimes have gotten better at managing this. They're, you know, they're importing surveillance systems from other countries and trying to get a better handle on these things, right? Then they looked at weak liberal democracies. And here they used Brazil as an example. And they said that, okay, in this context, it has a radicalizing effect, right? So you basically have populist candidates, right, who are able to spread misleading narratives, you know, that are polarizing, divisive, that attack the elite, right? And you use that to come into power and to tap into grievances, right? Essentially, that's what they're saying. Then they talk about strong authoritarian regimes. Here, mainly, they don't stick to one. They split between China and Russia. And again, here they say that they have an intensifying effect, right? That it actually strengthens the strong authoritarian regime because they're able to use knowledge power, right? That's in quotes. That's a term that they've referred to, which these platforms that are compliant in those particular countries. And they're able to amass a lot of data on citizens, etc. Right? And lastly, they spoke about strong democratic regimes, where they said that digital communication networks can have a weakening effect. And here they use the advantage of the example of the United States, and I think specifically focused on their recent election. Right.
Right. So these four demarcations have actually put in very clear terms as to how it affects a political regime. But I also wonder, where does India fall on this spectrum? Do we think of it as a weak democracy? Do we think of it as a strong democracy? And then moreover, we definitely see an impact of social media on India, and even with respect to elections and all the things that we've been seeing from the last two elections. But what is the actual impact, if at all it has been, you know, quantified or qualified with respect to social media?
No, it's actually a good question, right? I'm not sure where I would classify India in this, because I think there is scope for refining this further, right? We're just looking at it in terms of strong and weak, and you know, democratic or authoritarian, and they use certain parameters that they've described in the paper, right? For example, to determine whether it was democratic or not, I believe they looked at the VDEM, the scores of various countries. So I'm a little unsure, honestly, of where I would classify India. I think there is, and that, you know, in interestingly, that's one of the cases. So you referenced Technopolitik, right? And I wrote about this in the most recent edition of Technopolitik, and I sort of threw out a challenge for the readers, saying that, hey, you know, do you think we can expand the methodology they've used to try and fit in more countries and see whether this still holds, right? Because it's one thing to take case studies and define it. And then when you expand that to other countries, you want to test if the same framework still holds, or whether it needs to be expanded, right? And I think it's a great start. It helps you contextualize certain things. But as with most research concepts, I think there is scope for, you know, building on it and adding some more nuance to it.
Right, that's actually true. I mean, considering we still do not have a fixated definition for social media to actually see what exact impact it has had on the political regimes is definitely a difficult feat to achieve. But of course, I mean, from what I see a lot of change in the nature of political campaigns. I think this is something that we see so evidently during the pandemic and the lockdown, that especially I think in the most recent elections, when the entire political campaigns were taken to digital media and to, you know, digital forms of communication. And of course, there are we see comment wars. If I, it feels like this is a new term, way of having a war with others that you don't share the opinions with. And yes, we do see spread of false news and narratives even in our country. So maybe these are some ways that our readers could, that our listeners could think while looking at the case studies that you just mentioned. So I actually have another question now for you, that what do we do now? I mean, we've talked about the problems that social media has, and the, we cannot deny the good side of social media and how it has actually brought the world closer and is improving lives substantially. But from what I understand, the traditional laws and policies are not effective to limit the adverse impacts of social media platforms on democracy or politics. And the internet and these social media platforms, they neither have a spatial restriction nor a temporal. But our laws and policies are certainly bound by physical sovereignty. And with the increasing assimilation of the internet into everyday life, we cannot shut it down, and we can neither put a ban on social media platform, because it is not a legitimate solution at all. So, and of course, we understand that, you know, it's the government's responsibility to guarantee the right to freedom of opinion, freedom of speech, and of course, access to reliable sourced information. This is actually my major concern, that how do policymakers find this golden balance between the positive and adverse impacts of social media and internet?
Yeah, that's an extremely loaded question, right? And I'm going to say upfront that I'm probably not going to provide a satisfying answer for our listeners. But, you know, I think one of the themes I think that we've brought through in this conversation is that a lot of these effects are still to be understood, right? And that is, I think, the first principle, right? Where if we're going to regulate for something, we need to understand it better, right? So there definitely needs to be more India-centric research on how, you know, these are affecting collective behavior, right? There's substantial amount of literature on this from, you know, North American, Western European perspective in terms of even some of the psychosocial effects. I don't know how much of that has been translated into the Indian context to see whether it holds, whether it doesn't hold. Right? Should we just assume that the effects are going to be the same? Right? These are questions that we still have to answer. Right? So yes, we need to start there. The other aspect of it is there's also this question of, look, this is, you know, about our existing laws and policies. And there's this, I think, you know, if you go back, there's this concept thing, right, that technology always moves faster than law and policy. And in many respects, that's not changing, and that's not going away. But what we also have to keep in mind, I think, is that we don't overregulate this in, you know, because of moral panic, etc. You know, moral panic or purely misunderstanding the effects, right? I'm also not 100% convinced that, look, current laws are completely ineffective. I think at the margin, there is scope for a lot of our current laws to address some of these things. Again, now I'm not a legal expert, so take this with a pinch of salt. But I think, you know, we're seeing an increasing trend, right, to people taking to court to address, you know, to while taking issue with things that have been said on social media. Now, whether you can agree or disagree with it, that's happening, and I think that jurisprudence will take shape over the next few years, and we will evolve some sort of norms on what type of speech is allowed, what type of speech is not allowed, however imperfect those norms turn out to be, right? But I think there is certainly movement on that front, right? But one of the things that I would caution against is, you know, and I'm going to go back to this, right, that we need to understand these effects. I don't think it's effective policy to try and enforce sovereignty on these social media platforms, because you're also misattributing the problem in the sense that you're only looking at foreign platforms. You're not looking at the same effects that, you know, the effect that maybe, you know, an Indian platform is having, right? Some of the societal effects are going to be similar, if not the same, right? And if we're only regulating them from the perspective of, hey, you are a foreign company, you need to follow our laws, I think we're maybe misplacing the solution a little bit.
Right, this makes sense. And I think maybe not answers, but we've been able to give a lot of questions for our listeners and, of course, the policymakers to think about and probably come out with some sort of a refined understanding of social media, if not an exact understanding. And I just want to tell my listeners that the challenge that Prateek has thrown at you is still for grabs. So you should definitely read his article in the Technopolitan newsletter and, of course, try to extrapolate the existing information or the literature on this debate and try to come up with an India-specific solution or maybe a refined definition. And with this, we come to an end of another episode of All Things Policy. Prateek, I'm taking the words information, fidelity, and digital communication networks with me to think about and throughout the week. These are really interesting words and definitely add to my vocabulary now. So thank you, Prateek, for such an interesting conversation. It was a pleasure discussing how the worlds of social media and politics interact with each other. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Prateek.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.